In what way did your educational systems adapt to the Bologna process, and what were the consequences of that? Okay.
Shall I start?
Peter, yes. Yeah.
The Bologna system was introduced very early in the Netherlands. I think it was 2002, 2003, 2004, around that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, I was quite afraid at that time that we had just built up our philosophy program, especially the ethics and engineering courses. And the introduction of the Bologna program meant that all curricula had to be revised. And I was very afraid that our courses would, in the course of this revision, would be jeopardized. Yeah, and I was very glad to see, I forgot to end on that optimistic note. I was very glad to see that both the students and the staff members at that time objected to getting rid of these courses. They wanted to have them. And I think one of the reasons why that worked is because we started from this principle of co-teaching and co-development.
Yeah, but I was also thinking in terms of the whole educational systems in the Netherlands, because there seems to me to be a blurring of the boundaries between the HBO sector and the university sector. Sector now being entitled to carry out research. And I would like to ask you whether this has provided a new opportunity for the HBO sector to engage in this kind of activities that Larry and David propose.
So with the HBO, you mean the professional sub-university?
You were talking only about
the university,
technical universities with philosophy as kind of specialty. Yeah. But I was also thinking in broader terms of whether the Bologna process provided opportunities at other institutional types in your country.
No. In effect, the Bologna type was the Bologna change was not problematic for engineers. Although in the beginning, the government had decided to go from 5-year curriculum to a 4-year, so a three-year bachelor, 1-year master.
Yeah, okay.
But then they were convinced that they had to keep this 2-year master. It was originally a 5-year program. Many humanities and social sciences were not allowed to have a 5-year program. They were cut back to a 4-year program, a 3-year bachelor, and a 1-year master.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
And Christelle, how did this Bologna process turn out in France? Because there's a very diverse system. For example, at the university, there's the 2-1-1-1 system, 4.1 system. For a university degree. So how did you adapt to the Bologna process in France, and in which institutional type did it take place?
I'm maybe not the right person to answer, because for the engineering education, I will say that I don't see what has changed, but maybe someone, I'm not working in an engineering school, I'm not an insider, and I can just say that it was 5 years, and it's still 5 years, plus three being the main model. But at university, so outside the Grande École system, it used to be 2+1+1, and now it's 3+2. So three is called licence, and the 2 years after is a master degree in 2 years. But I'm maybe not the right person to answer
big
question.
So I will pass the word on to Javier. What was the outcome of the Bologna process in your country or in your institution?
Well, in my institution and in most of the institutions in Spain, we adopted a different system. It was 4+2. Originally, engineering was 5 years. Even if you have some professional schools that gave you like a bachelor with 3 years, but then the pressures from both sides combined took to a degree in 4 years and then master 2 years, which is the two regulated professions. First one is 4 years, and there is another regulated profession with 2 more years.
So I have another question, perhaps also a question for the audience, because I would have liked to ask this question a little earlier, but then it turned out to be too late. So it might be inappropriate to bring in a social justice perspective related to what Larry and David has proposed, but I see it this way. Usually some students are risk adverse towards the kind of higher education where there is no direct link to employment after. So the question is this initiative limited to a number of, elite students or elite institutions to the detriment of lower social strata? Or how do you see it, all of you? Would it in somehow make some kind of, would there be some kind of social bias linked to it? Or would that be far away from, I mean, this is not the idea, but it could be a consequence of it. I mean, it's 3 years, it's a bachelor, which doesn't provide any opportunity for getting a job. So to get a job as an engineer, you have to take another one to get the job. So my question is, would there be some kind of social bias related to it?
I would say this is, I guess it's different in every country, but as Peter Cross said before, I see it differently from the point of view of Spain. In Spain, to have a job is not the most common motivation to get some studies. As a matter of fact, journalism, for instance, where is quite unprofession, which is there is a lot of unemployment, is one of the most demanded studies in Spain, and some other, psychology or things like that. That there even history, which is famously in Spain, if you say that you are going to study history, you mean you will be unemployed forever. But there is still a demand. So I think students are not directly related to find a job when they choose. They choose more by their election.
So there's some question from the audience, please.
Yeah, comment more. Peter, I appreciated your thinking about critical thinking. And we've talked earlier today about the STEM to STEAM transition where you bring the arts in. And in most of the literature on that, we see the arts as offering creativity to engineering. But the arts also has a very strong tradition of critique, artists critiquing each other's work. And that might be something else that bringing the arts in to STEM programs might accomplish, is for engineers to become more critical of other engineers' work.
There's another question.
Yeah, I don't want to be the downer at the end of the day, but I want to be realistic. Both Stina and Javier mentioned this whole thing about what's your degree worth. And does everybody know what Davos is? This is when all the big bankers and corporate guys get together in Spain talking Davos. Okay, well, Jamie Dimon, who is the head of J.P. Morgan, which is probably one of the most powerful positions in the United States right now and most corrupt, but nonetheless, Jamie Dimon just gave a talk and he said, okay, I got two recommendations of how to get things going. One is we need physical infrastructure. Okay. Then he said we need to look at education, and we need to where the jobs are and stuff like that. And we need to do an evaluation of the value to the person coming out of that job as to what the value is, which is obviously engineering's got. So basically, he wants to get rid of history, philosophy, political theory. I mean, you name it. All the humanities, all sorts of sciences. What this very powerful guy is saying is just the opposite of what we're talking about today. He's saying get rid of all that junk, you know. Last thing. So there's a guy who was the CEO of Intel, a guy named Andy Grove, wrote a great book called Only the Paranoid Survive. And Andy Grove also made a comment. We were about like trying, hey, we need more engineers. I said, what do you need more engineers? Give them some value education. Nah, they don't need valuable education. I just want them to grind out code. I'm going to put them in a cubicle and let them write code until they burn out and then throw them out. So when people go into engineering, you know, you got like, what kind of job are you going to get into here with some of these corporations? I think it's better in a lot of them, but there's a sense of like, oh, great, I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to start out at $70,000 a year, and I'm going to burn out within 5 or 10 years, and then what am I going to do? Anyway, so just a couple of questions.
But aren't we talking about value systems here?
Sure, absolutely. So. I mean, he's just saying it's all money. You know, get rid of philosophy degree, what's it working? Mm-hmm.
There's another question, please.
Can I?
Yeah.
I'm Susan Silby, MIT. So I want to just make a few separate comments on some of these comments. First, directly to the issue of the worth of a degree. We did some research several years ago following a cohort of students through 4 engineering schools, Smith, Olin, MIT, and UMass. We followed these students for 10 years. We still have a panel of them. We have a very interesting paper which I think has a possibly new explanation for some of the gendering in engineering. It goes like this. If you enter school to be an engineer and you graduate as an engineer, women earn on the average $17,000 less than the men. If you enter to be an engineer, but then you transfer into another major, the women earn $17,000, it's oddly the same, $17,000 more than the men. Women are being rewarded in the marketplace for some technical education. Men, according to our data, which we validated with two national labor studies, shows that men have an economic incentive to stay in engineering even if they don't like it. Okay? Another paper we published on this, on why women leave, is because they don't find it interesting. They don't want to just do what somebody tells them to do. So that's... So then about philosophy and anthropology, where I was the head at MIT for 8 years, I want to tell you the story about an anthropologist. She's very well known. Her name is Gillian Tett. Some of you may know her. She writes for the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. She studied anthropology, I think, at Cambridge. And she couldn't get a job, so she started doing journalism. And she analyzed in 2005 to about 7, around there, several banks. She studied J.P. Morgan. She studied Goldman Sachs. She studied several of them. And she was astounded by the behavior of the people in these banks, that they were behaving in such a way counter to most of the norms that have sustained human groups over human history, that they were going to destroy their own nest. And she wrote that, and she was right. Okay? That's what's made her famous. Now, the last thing I would say is that for many years, my husband was dean of science at MIT. And when he would go out to raise money for the institute, he came back always, and maybe he just said it to me to feel better. He would say to me, you know, it's the most amazing thing what they all say. They all say, I wish I could go back and this time do it right.
Thank you. John?
I just wanted to make a quick comment about differing perspectives from the two sides of the Atlantic, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to, again, reach back to the earliest days of the American higher educational system. American universities all along from the beginning, although we often forget about it now, as several people have mentioned, were largely founded for public purposes. There was a civic role in the creation of the American higher educational system. And you can read it all in all of our charters. It's in there. You will not find that in the old European universities, that this was about creating citizens of what were eventually, in the United States, free societies. And that's a crucial distinction. And unfortunately, as was noted from the comment of Jamie Dimon, even some of our most important citizens have lost sight of that. But I think it is related to the theme of why it is that we're talking about the subject we're talking about today. Thank you.
Other questions? John?
Steve, just from the perspective of the British Isles, I deliberately refused Larry's request to join you because I'm not up to date on what they try and say would be a liberal education. But to answer your questions about the Bologna process, whether or not it's the process, or whether or not it's something indigenous in both Ireland and England, the slide that you put up, the overhead that you put up, which said that arts departments were being pushed down and almost pushed out of it, operates in both the British Isles and the United Kingdom in all the countries and in Ireland. There is no doubt that arts people fear for their jobs. I'm very proud to have a son who's a very distinguished historian, and I talked to him about students coming. He's in Scotland, and he's even worried for his job because the Scottish Department of Education is removing history from the school curriculum. Can you believe it? So that there's no doubt whether that's to do with the Bologna process or the utilitarian model of education, which I think it's more to do with. And when you're looking at the history of higher education, you need to go back to the Scottish Oxford debate of 1800 and to understand that it was the Scots and Adam Smith that won that debate, because it turned from a broad general education, except for the elite, I didn't see who was talking about the civil side. The Scots won, and you've had this specialist education develop ever since. And you cannot contrast the system of education in the United Kingdom with that on the continent, because it's always been a tightly coupled system. That is, you have to do your subjects at school on which your entry is based at certain times. So 14 is a cutoff for making decisions about where you go. My granddaughter's having awful problems with making her decisions. She's 14 at the moment, and unfortunately, she's what we call A-starred across all the subjects. And, you know, where does she go? She wants to do a science, and she wants to do a language. She can't find a university to go in. I just tell her to go to Cambridge and Oxford, simply because the value of their degrees is not engineering, it's the social networks, which is how a status-oriented society works. So this tight coupling has always led to a three-year degree in engineering, which the engineers managed to fight the government to get 4 years. Now, I doubt very much that they'll get 5 years. And what you have to watch now is the European Union is in a mess, big time. Its economy is struggling. During the heydays, it spent loads of money, like getting a Bologna process with its 7, 8 years or whatever it is. Huge amounts of money, for example, in health and safety, which everybody's got to abide by. But people's salaries haven't increased. They're going like that, irrespective of the nation that you're in. A few people are increasing at the top. So you've got the same sort of problem that you've got here. And ultimately, here and there, you're not going to pay for the higher education that you've got without the students paying for it. And since the wages are static and you've increased in this country, your fees to university, or costs of university, have gone up by 225% in a 20-year period. At some stage, the whole thing is going to collapse. So the question you have to ask is, are you in a higher education bubble?
May I make one brief comment here? I mean, the situation with regard to tuition fees, the cost of a study, is completely different from the United States and, I think, England, from the European mainland. I mean, in the Netherlands, students pay a tuition which is very low, and now if they think it's too high, they go to Belgium because they can get their education for free, or they go to Germany where it's also for free. So the situation is really, really different. There's not an investment. There's not such an investment to be made. Yeah.
I think it's important, before we take the next, to take the following into consideration. There's a big difference between the American system of higher education and European system of higher education, because according to Martin True, the higher education system in the United States were in place for massification already at the turn of the 20th century, whereas in Europe, the system was designed from the 60s onward to cope with massification of higher education. And therefore, institutional transformation in Europe took place from the 60s and onwards, and they're still ongoing. And part of the Bologna process was to speed up the process of institutional change. And these institutional changes are not unimportant because they allow or inhibit initiatives like the one we are discussing here today. So this is the main point. And there's another difference. Martin Trow also noticed that some of these initiatives that we're discussing here took place in upper secondary education in Europe, which he saw as university extensions downward, whereas he saw upper secondary education in the United States as primary education extensions upward. So in Europe, there was this relationship between upper secondary education and universities from the start, which means that some of the topics that we're dealing with here could be presented in upper secondary education.
Steve, it would be worthwhile telling the audience.
Yeah,
you probably don't know who Martin Trow is, but Martin Trow was professor of higher education at UCLA.
Yeah.
And he's
no.
had a massive influence.
Berkeley.
He's had a massive influence on the